From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Today on the program, Phil Berrigan on this St. Patrick's Day, an exclusive interview with the legendary imprisoned Plowshares activists. Also, Vermont House passes landmark gay rights legislation, and the last days of Indonesian Army Battalion 745, their orders, shoot everything, destroy everything. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, here with Juan Gonzalez, and it is a momentous day in Vermont. Lesbian and gay couples could be walking down the aisle in Vermont by this fall. In a historic step yesterday, the State House voted 76-69 to adopt a bill allowing gay men and lesbians to form civil unions that mirror marriage and provide all the same rights and benefits. If the bill becomes law, the state will have gone further than any other in recognizing same-sex couples. We're joined on the line now by Nina Beck. She is one of three couples who brought the case that went to the Vermont Supreme Court that led to this ultimate vote in the state legislature. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Nina Beck.
Thank you. Good morning.
So what are your feelings today?
We are just very excited today. We spent much of the last 2 days in the Vermont State Legislature watching the legislators do their work, and it was really an incredible experience. We are thrilled with this. We think that it's, you know, the biggest step that anyone has taken thus far towards equality and civil rights for gay and lesbian people in this country, and it's a fantastic thing.
We're also on the phone with David Goodman, reporting for Mother Jones Magazine on the Vermont decision. David, can you set the scene yesterday and the day before in the legislature?
Well, the last 2 days, by most legislators' account, including the lieutenant governor, are unlike any that the Vermont State House has ever seen before. It has been a very emotional time in Montpelier. The vote on the bill, which has taken place actually over 2 days, it was voted on first on Wednesday and approved, and then it goes to a second reading on yesterday, and it was approved again both times. The vote's taken late at night after marathon sessions. There has been feverish campaigning, both by opponents and supporters of civil unions during these last few days. Anti-abortion activist Randall Terry, who people may recall was a leader of Operation Rescue and has spent time in jail for his work doing that, set up an office one block from the State House, and I visited there yesterday. They were despondent over what they perceived as their impending defeat. They have been trying to rally national opposition to the Vermont law. It was notable that in the office there yesterday, there was not a single Vermonter. There were one gentleman from Missouri, another a pastor from Alabama. Terry was working the floor, alternately threatening and cajoling members that he would do everything he could to have them defeated in November. But the opponents really are not the main story here. It is the supporters of civil unions that really had some of the emotional highlights these last few days. Both on Wednesday and yesterday, the House floor fell silent when the House's lone openly gay member, Representative Bill Lippert, stood to speak in kind of a final plea to his colleagues to support this legislation. And what he said over these last 2 days was that, as he said on Wednesday night, that the love of gay and lesbian couples was a triumph against discrimination and bigotry that they have all faced, and that he stood as the only member in the chamber of the House, the 150 members there, who did not have the rights that everyone else enjoyed to marry his partner of many years. And yesterday, last night, in a very tense moment when it was very unclear how the vote would go, Bill Lippert stood again to declare, to recall publicly to his colleagues how his father, who was a minister, had stood around reading the Bible to the family, but one line had stuck out over all these years, and that was the line, "Love thy neighbor as thyself," and he urged his colleagues that they had nothing to fear from gay couples and that they should do as that biblical incantation suggests.
Well, I'd like to ask Nina Beck, what is going to be the implication or the effect across other states of the decisions of Vermont? Will the unions be recognized in other states, or could you tell us a little bit about that?
It's my understanding that civil union will be recognized only in Vermont. That is one of the issues that came up when we discussed something called civil union as opposed to something called marriage, because marriage has that portability. It's recognized in other states. It's recognized across state lines, across international lines. Civil union is a new thing. You know, if Vermont takes this bill all the way to the end and it becomes law, it will be the first of its kind in this country, and so we don't really know what will happen in terms of nationally, internationally. We know for sure that it will be recognized here in Vermont, and beyond that, the other states will have to do their work on deciding, you know, where they stand in relationship to it.
And what are the aspects of domestic life that will be covered by the new law?
Pardon me?
What are the aspects of domestic life?
The bill mirrors the marriage statutes, basically. And so in every place where in the marriage statutes it says husband, wife, or partner, it will be a reference to a partner in a civil union. So the benefits of this should be just the same within the state of Vermont as the benefits of civil marriage, which are many. There's hundreds within the state and thousands if you look federally of benefits, rights, responsibilities, and supports that are provided by civil marriage. They range from protection of children in case of separation of the couple, in case of death. They range, it's a huge range of benefits that come with civil marriage.
Will you be headed down to your town hall to get a license for your civil union?
Absolutely.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Nina Beck and David Goodman. David Goodman writing for Mother Jones on this historic Vermont decision. And Nina Beck, one of the people who really started the ball rolling on this decision that started in court and has ended up in the Vermont legislature. In a historic step, the Vermont State House yesterday voted 76-69 to adopt a bill allowing gay men and lesbians to form civil unions that mirror marriage and provide all the same rights and benefits. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! In just a minute, we're going down to the Baltimore Detention Center to talk with Phil Berrigan. But before we go there, a quick hit out on the street of New York, where the St. Patrick's Day parade is beginning, but also lesbians and gay men from around the world, from Ireland and New York, are marching and expecting to be arrested today because they're not allowed to be included as a group in the St. Patrick's Day parade. John McDonough, a producer with Pacifica Station WBAI Radio Free Erin, is on the street. Welcome, John.
Thanks, Amy, for having me on. I'm down here on Fifth Avenue looking over at Trump Towers, and in front of the Plaza Hotel, there are about 200 protesters here on Fifth Avenue demonstrating that they cannot march in the St. Patrick's Day parade here in Manhattan, where they can march in Queens and practically any St. Patrick's Day parade in Ireland.
And are they planning to get arrested?
Yes, it's become, unfortunately, an annual tradition here on Fifth Avenue, where the Irish Gay and Lesbian Organization will try to hop, I guess, about two barriers, wooden horses and the cattle pen, and try to go off the Fifth Avenue and stop Hillary and Rudy from coming up Fifth Avenue.
Yeah, and John, what about the situation with First Lady Hillary Clinton, who apparently had been trying to divide the baby in two and participate in two parades? Could you tell us a little bit about that for our listeners across the country?
It's typical of her stance, what she did with the Puerto Rican political prisoners. She comes out one day that she's against people being excluded from the parade, but yet she'll march in the parade that will exclude people. So she is being a bit hypocritical. She tried to get around this by marching at a St. Patrick's Day parade in Queens last Sunday to say that she marched in a parade that included Irish gays and lesbians. So that gives her the right to march today on Fifth Avenue. But as you know, it's all politics. And if Rudy's going to march and get on television here on Fifth, she wants her 15 seconds tonight on the national news.
Well, John McDonough, we hope to hear from you by the end of the program as well. We also understand Pacifica reporter Laura Flanders is out there, too, to see what happens in this hour and what will happen with the International Lesbian and Gay Organization as they try to be a part of the St. Patrick's celebration in New York. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move now to another Irish story, I think you could say, a great Irishman in this country, Philip Berrigan. Unfortunately, as we speak to him, he is behind bars. On Sunday, December 19th, he and three other people, Susan Crane, Stephen Kelly, Elizabeth Waltz, called themselves the Plowshares versus Depleted Uranium Group and disarmed two A-10 Warthog aircraft. The aircraft were located at the Maryland National Guard Base in Middle River. Following Isaiah's vision of a disarmed world, the activists hammered and poured blood on the A-10s because the Warthog, used against Iraq and Yugoslavia, has a Gatling gun which fires depleted uranium and ammunition. They are going to court next week. We're in court last week for motions, and we go now to the Baltimore Detention Center, where Phil Berrigan is being held. Welcome to Democracy Now! Phil Berrigan, are you there? Phil Berrigan, can you hear us?
Yes, Amy, you'll have to speak loud. It's fairly noisy here.
Well, it's very good to have you with us. Can you explain why you're behind bars on this St. Patrick's Day?
Yeah, I didn't get that, Amy.
Can you explain why you are behind bars on this St. Patrick's Day?
Business of depleted uranium, U-238, is largely overlooked. And yet it's one of the most important issues currently, simply because it's a nuclear weapon and because we fought with nuclear weapons in Iraq for the second time and in Yugoslavia for the third time. It's a scandal and a tragedy, and of course tens of thousands of people are affected now and are ill or dead, and many more will die because we use this terrible, hellish weapon. So that's by and large why we went to Warfield Air Force Base and disarmed the two Warthogs.
Phil Berrigan, you have been now demonstrating and being arrested for decades now in your continued quest to achieve some rational peace in the world and an end to these weapons of destruction. Do you feel that as the years have passed that anyone is listening to the efforts that you're involved in?
I'm sorry, because of the noise, I'm not hearing you at all.
Maybe my voice is sharper than Juan's. He's asking if you feel, after all these decades, you're making a difference.
I hope a little difference, Amy. We've got a trial coming up next Monday, and the likelihood is that it's going to be another kangaroo experience. Already we've been deprived of our expert witnesses. We had four of them coming in from all over the country. But we'll see. We'll try to sift some truth through the cracks.
What about the motions that were denied by your defense team? You asked for international experts like Francis Boyle on international law. They were denied. How will you make your case for what you did?
How was what, Amy?
How will you make your case since your international experts have been denied? They won't be allowed in court.
the basis for their denial was, of course, that they were irrelevant. The state is charging us for what we admitted doing, because we stood by for arrest, and we were proud of what we did. They take the luxury of judging any testimony as to why we did it irrelevant. And that's the basis for it, as far as I can understand, under all the legalese.
And how are the other prisoners at the Baltimore Detention Center relating to you and to your issue? Are they interested at all, or what's their response to your willingness to go to jail?
They're a little perplexed by this, many, of course, come off the top of their head and say, well, this is stupid, man. What the hell are you acting this way for? But a little explanation brings them around. We have to understand that most of the prisoners here are poor guys, and they look up at the system from below. They stand under it, another paraphrase for understanding. And so they're not like middle-class or upper-middle-class Americans who are defending a great deal. And a defense that's kind of embodied in these awful warplanes and depleted uranium, if you follow me.
Yes, we're speaking with Phil Berrigan in the Baltimore Detention Center, where he's being held until his trial next week. Phil Berrigan, I had a chance to talk to you 2 years ago on St. Patrick's Day in Virginia. You were in prison there for another Plowshares action in Maine. You were out for just a few months before you began to disarm on the two A-10 Warthogs at the Maryland National Guard base in Middle River. How many years do you expect to face now?
The other day in court, Amy, the sabotage charge was dropped. It appears that the judge is, trying to please everyone. He drops the sabotage charge and then takes away expert witnesses. Mm-hmm. But in any event, I suppose if we're convicted, we could get in around 10 years, something like that. We won't get that because of the support we're getting. There'll be people out in the street as well as filling the courtroom. And, of course, the powers that be always take a very, very acute look at the kind of support you have. Mm-hmm. And our support has been magnificent, just as it was up in Maine. So we're hoping to do what we can. It's in their ballpark, and the rules are all there. And they're manipulating protection for the Pentagon. And we're not under any illusion about that.
And for those who are who live in the Washington, D.C., Baltimore area and might want to attend your trial, where will the trial be held?
It'll be held out in Towson, Maryland, at district court here.
We can give the address.
Towson is just north of Baltimore itself. And it's fairly easy to find. And anyone can get particulars and details from Jonah House. The number is 410-233-6238.
That number again is 410-233-6238, Jonah House, the house of community activists in Baltimore, Maryland, where Phil Berrigan lives when he is not in prison, where Liz McAllister, the well-known Plowshares activist, lives, as well as a number of other people who are part of their family. Phil Berrigan, what words do you have for listeners around the country today on St. Patrick's Day, a day after the U.S. and Britain again bombed Iraq, a day when tensions are heightening in Kosovo?
Well, Amy, I believe with all my heart that the only resource left to us is one of conscience and systematically, it's a resource of awakened people, as during the Vietnam era. So the Americans are going to have to wake up. There's no alternative to that. Otherwise, the empire's wars are going to flourish in the 21st century as they did in the 20th. People are going to have to wake up, and they're going to have to take to the streets and go to the hell holes, the war factories, the military bases. They're going to have to appear at the White House and the Pentagon and the Department of Energy in large numbers, similar to what was done in Seattle over the World Trade Organization, if we're going to get some check upon the warriors who dominate so much in this country and in Washington.
Do you feel there's any hope presented by the Campaign 2000 presidential race?
The campaign for the presidency?
Yes.
No, none whatsoever. It's changing the palace guard. The only hope that will come in this country is from the people. And if it doesn't come from us, then it won't come. And we're just facing more of the same and worse than what we've experienced recently. And it's going to be hell for people overseas.
Last question. How old are you now, Phil Berrigan?
I'm 76, Amy.
76. How many years have you spent in prison? How many years have you spent in prison?
Well, I'm into my 10th year now, and I don't boast about that. I'm just reporting. It's the little offering that I can make against the institutionalized terror that's abroad under the heading of the American Empire.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Phil Berrigan, longtime anti-war activist, one of the founders of the Plowshares movement, the original member of the Catonsville Nine who burned their draft records during the Vietnam War, has spent more than a decade in prison. Again, the trial for Phil Berrigan, Susan Crane, Stephen Kelly, and Elizabeth Waltz, who on December 19th disarmed two A-10 Warthog aircraft, will take place next week, March 20th, in the morning. I understand there'll be a demonstration. The trial is at the Baltimore County Circuit Court, Room 3, 401 Towson, Maryland. For those who are in the area or who want to go, that's the Baltimore County Circuit Court, Room 3, 401 Avenue, Towson, Maryland. Phil Berrigan, we want to thank you very much for being with us from the Baltimore Detention Center. Thank you. Thank you for calling in. We held off the break for a bit because we were afraid we'd lose Phil. Phil Berrigan, again, our guest. When we come back, we're going to The Hague, where an international conference is taking place on water and water privatization. And then we head to Tokyo to talk to a reporter who traced the last day of one of the Indonesian battalions in East Timor, Battalion 745, and the killings that it engaged in before it left. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. And before we move to the World Water Forum at The Hague, there is news from where we're broadcasting from in New York. That's right, another police killing of an unarmed man. And it happened two nights ago. Juan?
Yes, this time the victim's name was Patrick Dorimond, 26 years old and a father of two. In East Flatbush, Brooklyn, he was actually shot in Midtown Manhattan, right near Madison Square Garden, when he was supposedly approached by some undercover or narcotics officers who tried to ask him if he knew where they could buy marijuana, and he apparently got angry at them. He didn't know that there were police officers. An altercation ensued. Backup police came. And one of the backup officers, who are called ghosts because they come to the support of the undercovers, shot the man once in the chest. The officer was Anthony Vasquez. There's been conflicting reports so far. The police department has kept changing its story of what actually happened. It was initially reported supposedly as a robbery attempt of the officers, and there's still no clear story. But one thing is clear. Is that the victim had no gun and was not involved in any crime at the time that the police accosted him.
That's right. His name, Patrick Dorisman, named, ironically enough, for St. Patrick's Day. He was Haitian. He lives in Brooklyn. And we'll continue to bring you more on that story as it unfolds. But right now we are turning to The Hague, to the World Water Forum, which got underway this morning in the Netherlands. It's organized by the World Bank, a conference calling for radical changes in the way water services are subsidized, especially in the world's poorest regions. Water demand is expected to increase by 40% over the next two decades, and a key aspect will be the involvement of the private sector in the management of water resources. A report has been released by the World Bank and the United Nations calling for a hike in water prices in developing countries, and dozens of delegates from non-governmental organizations, environmental groups, and others are at The Hague to protest the plans for water privatization. They're hammering home the message that commercialization of water is unpopular, undemocratic, and unnecessary. And we're joined on the phone now by Jamie Dunn, who is a water expert with the Council of Canadians, who just got to The Hague for the opening ceremonies. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hi, how are you doing?
It's good to have you with us. So what happened today at this opening ceremony of the World Water Forum?
Well, what we saw is the privatization flag came out, and what we're going to hear, it was clear that what we're going to hear for the next several days, or next week, actually, is just the old story about how governments have failed, how the private sector has to step in and save the world from government mismanagement.
Well, Jamie Dunn, in many places in the world, it's not even a question of privatization versus government. It's a question that there is not sufficient potable water that can meet the needs of people. I know in Haiti, even 80% of the people in the capital city don't have running water. How are they getting into so deeply into the issue of privatizing water supplies when the issue of providing water supply is so critical to many parts of the world?
Well, that's a great question, because that's the one that has to be answered. What we hear over and over again is that these companies can come in with all of their money and capital, and they can provide it where governments can't, or the governments are simply too corrupt. But what we find out is that the water companies, the capital they use is all open market capital. They go to the World Bank, they go to all of the main financial institutions, and they're actually one of the worst investors in water services. So they're just simply using everybody else's money to make a lot of profits off of people. They drive the prices up, which actually does disenfranchise people and deprive them of clean water. And finally, that the companies are just as corrupt as the worst governments in the world. Just yesterday it was announced that Vivendi, a company that has revenues of over $35 billion a year, has been implicated in a major bribery scandal over Milan Water Works, a contract in excess of $220 million. So if you're talking about escaping corruption, going to the biggest multinationals in the world is not the way to do it.
The World Bank has attempted to carve out for itself a new image in recent years as one that is more concerned about people policies, let's say, than international groups like the IMF or others. What is the World Bank's role in terms of assuring the development of water supplies around the world?
Well, the World Bank's role is increasingly becoming one of the strong arm of privatization. They're going into countries like Paraguay and withholding development money until the country deregulates and privatizes its water industries. And that was a story that was happening last year, and I'm not sure if it's even been resolved yet. So the World Bank holds out with usually actually only the make or break 5 or 10%. The rest is all domestic money, and then forces deregulation and privatization, while it belongs to organizations like the World Water Council, which is also chaired by some of the biggest water corporations in the world.
We're talking to Jamie Dunn at The Hague, a water expert at the Council of Canadians. He's at The Hague for the World Water Forum. Can you tell us which are the corporations in the world today that are involved with water, the privatization of water?
Well, the big two, they're called the Ford and General Motors of the water industry, are Vivendi, which is a French company, and Suez Lyonnais des Eaux, another French company. Together in 1998, they had revenues in excess of $70 billion and profits in excess of $2 billion. And what we were hearing here is we're hearing examples of where they've gone around the country and created showcase projects. And what we're saying is, you know, you've got to watch these examples, because these companies can stand to lose millions of dollars on the front end, completely devoted to public relations. And then sign 30 and 40 year contracts, and that's an average contract in this industry, and make their money in the long run.
And how much of the increasing demand for water around the world is a result of just population growth, and how much of it is a result of wasteful agricultural policies?
Well, population is definitely a factor. We're getting 85 million new people every year, but it's not the main factor. Consumption of water is growing at double the rate of population growth worldwide. And the main consumers of water are industry and agriculture. Domestic consumption is only 6 to 10% of water consumption worldwide. And increasingly, as industry gets into agriculture, you're seeing that it's just industrial water use.
Can you tell us why your organization, the Council of Canadians, is involved with the issue of water and just what the Council of Canadians is?
Well, the Council of Canadians is a public interest watchdog in Canada that's solely funded by its over 100,000 members. We don't accept government or corporate money so that we aren't beholden to anyone in our criticisms. Why we got involved, we've been involved since the signing of the Free Trade Agreement in 1988, because water was in the trade agreement as a good, turning it into a good like any other, just another commodity like tennis rackets or Barbie dolls. And we didn't think that was right, considering people are dependent for their lives on water, and as the environment, it's the lifeblood of the environment. Recently, we stepped up our efforts with the NovaCorp's bid to export 600 million liters of Lake Superior water, realizing that this would trigger, under trade agreements, an open tap on water both in Canada and the United States. So we stepped up our efforts to bring people's attention to the threat to the environment of water exports, the injustice of water exports and privatization of water, and also the threat that trade deals pose because they take away our ability to regulate those industries.
Is it your sense that in the United States and Canada, with their remarkable network of rivers and lakes that supply fresh water, that there's a lack of consciousness, really, of the fundamental importance of a water supply to people around the world?
Oh, absolutely. I think people have missed the boat, and I think that's what's being used against them in this argument, that somehow they are being inhumane if they don't export or otherwise privatize water. And the reality of the situation is we should be leading the way in governing and stewarding water resources. I mean, only 3% of the Great Lakes shoreline is suitable for swimming or fishing or supporting life. 40% of the rivers in the United States are severely damaged. And in the Arctic, as far north as the high Arctic, you see the outcome of industrial pollutants in the water systems. So we have some major work to do, but at the same time, we can't be goaded into, through guilt, leading privatization, which is what these companies want to do.
What do you suggest now how people can be involved with the issue of water? I don't think 10 years ago most people in this country thought that they would be buying water, but it's become routine, buying spring water. People's afraid to use the water from their tap. Can you talk about what actions the Council Canadiens recommends?
Well, what we've done in Canada with trade unions and with social justice organizations across the board and environmental organizations is we formed what we're calling the Water Watch Movement. And it's community-based coalitions of anyone who's interested in water issues and understanding that as communities we have to take control of our water, strive to live within our local water resources, and also to pressure decision-makers about the standards and the ethical position that they start their water management from. Water is a basic human right. It is not a right to have affordable water. It's a right to have water. Affordability is an issue of price, and that's a market argument. The issue is, do we have a right to water, and do we start our management from there and our protection of the environment? When you talk about pricing, the fundamental issue from an environmental perspective is who's going to buy water for the environment? Who's going to buy water for the fish and the animals if we just carve it up amongst corporations and subject it to price?
And what do you expect that at the forum that the protests outside are having an impact on the meeting of the delegates to the forum in The Hague?
I don't. That's what we're trying to make a dent in. Trust me when I say this is a sealed system. It is not only about not hearing objections, it's also about not facilitating them. An international meeting like this, and there is not one translator. This is an English environment, and English is the language of business. In our small group we've brought together, we're translating into three or four languages simultaneously just through volunteers who've come to help so we can all understand each other's position. As we attract more and more NGOs who question this market approach. But here inside, it's a wonderful world of business, it's a wonderful world of English only, and it's a wonderful world of the market will save us all.
And are there any nations around the world, any governments that are taking particularly progressive positions on this and trying to carve an independent path, or is everyone, or all the governments more or less going along with the privatization strategy?
Governments are mostly split. There is an acute schizophrenia among governments. The Canadian government is a great example. The Canadian International Development Agency, which is CEDA in Canada, is one of the leaders of this forum. Meanwhile, the Foreign Affairs Ministry in Canada is saying that water should never be a commodity. And as you talk to people from different countries, that's the message they're saying, that there's a complete split within governments. But it's the ministries with the power, the industry ministries, the trade ministries that are driving this privatization message, and they are the ones that are under the most intense lobbying by these huge corporations.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, and I want to ask if people want to get in touch with the Council of Canadians or the coalition of groups that are working on the issue of water, where can they call?
Well, the easiest way is they can visit our website at www.canadians.org. Or in North America, they can call 1-800-387-7177.
That's 1-800-387-7177. Jamie Dunn, a water expert of the Council Canadians, today at the World Water Forum at The Hague as they talk about the issue of water and water privatization. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back from our break, we're going to Tokyo to talk with a Christian Science Monitor reporter who's just finished a week-long series following one particular Indonesian battalion in East Timor. It's called A Brutal Exit. Welcome to Dili. Don't even tell your wives what you did. And we'll find out about his investigation over the last few months of Battalion 745, what they did in East Timor, and how this fits into the international context of whether there will be war crimes tribunals. In the days before the battalion left, at least 20 Timorese they killed as they pass by on the road, as well as a Monitor correspondent, Sander Tunis, who was shot off his motorcycle as he rode through the streets of the capital of Dili, East Timor. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Power to the people, Sang, Johnny Lennon, 20 years later, we're back at the beginning. Single waiting round for divine intervention. Take to the streets if you're looking for redemption.
Songs played by the man called Black for the Silver in an island of Mexico.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. I'm looking at Thursday's Christian Science Monitor, the third of a four-part series, A Brutal Exit, Battalion 745. It's by Cameron Barr, and it says, Battalion 745 was shipping out. By mid-September, many of its 600 troops had already left their compound on the plateau of Los Palos. Civilians had fled the area with good reason. Near the beachfront warehouse the soldiers were using as a staging area, someone had painted a warning, if you're tired of living, we're ready to serve you. Before leaving, a lieutenant named Camilo briefed a sergeant and his fellow soldiers. The officer said, if you find anything on the way, just shoot it. Their orders, destroy everything, shoot anything. Cameron Barr now joins us from Tokyo. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Amy, good morning. Nice to talk to you.
It's good to have you with us. So we're also joined by Juan Gonzalez. Cameron, why don't you lay out the last days of the Indonesian Battalion 745 in mid-September as it left East Timor after the historic vote of August 30th?
Well, as you remember, the results of that vote were announced on the 4th, and working on leads from human rights investigators, I met three different families in the Los Palos area whose relatives had been killed by Battalion 745 troops in the days following the announcement of the vote. And these people, I think there are eight of them in all, were prominent people in Los Palos who had campaigned for East Timorese independence. They were leaders of the movement to evict the Indonesians. And there seems to be a pattern of these killings over about a 10-day period that that the battalion was seeking out those leaders and trying to eliminate them before leaving the territory. Towards the end of the month, on the 20th, as you just read, the convoy massed at a seaside area in Lautum. Most of them, about 500 of the 600 troops in the battalion, boarded a troop ship, and another 100 mounted trucks to take a convoy from Los Palos, which is at the very eastern tip of the territory, toward the west, toward West Timor, which is a part of Indonesia. And it took them, it's not a very long trip, about 150 miles to the border, maybe a little bit longer than that, only took them 2 days. And they covered the first 40 miles, which took place right after, when you just read the part about the soldiers receiving their orders, they covered 40 miles. And then the next day, the 21st, was a day in which, according to our investigation, 13 people died at the hands of the battalion. Most of these people were, in fact, all of them really were killed indiscriminately, as opposed to the earlier killings, which seemed to be more targeted. And in the very beginning of the day, the convoy left from a town called Laga, and proceeded, which is not far from the city of Baucau, the sort of second city of East Timor. And they passed through two villages in which they killed six people, including an elderly woman who was running from troops holding guns and was shot in the chest. I talked to relatives of a woman who had been cowering behind some bushes with her young daughter. The woman was killed by automatic weapons fire from a Battalion 745 soldier, and her four-year-old was hit in the thigh, and has survived. And there were, as I say, six killings leading up to the city of Baucau. Then the convoy proceeded. It came to a town called Lalea, where members of the Falentil, the East Timorese Independence Guerrilla Army, were waiting for them because they were worried that the convoy might take a turn off inland and go to a Falentil camp. And at that site, there was a firefight that lasted about 2 hours. A member of the convoy was injured. Four Falentil fighters were injured. And the convoy entered the city of Lalea and started doing a house-to-house search. There they apprehended two young men whose names are not known and a woman, and proceeded to another city, Manatutu. Those two young men have never been seen again. And when residents of Lalea returned from the hills where they had been hiding, they found two bodies in the town, and they attribute the deaths of those two men to Battalion 745. At that point, the convoy was approaching Dili, and a British journalist by the name of John Swain, an American photographer colleague, and two Timorese colleagues were in a taxi outside the city. The convoy encountered them. Its soldiers harassed and menaced these four men horribly. John Swain's driver was hit so hard in the head with a rifle butt that he lost an eye, and their interpreter was abducted by the battalion, and he has also never been seen again. Then the convoy proceeded through, this is the suburb of Bakora outside Dili. They proceeded into the town. I talked to a young man in Bakora who said that the battalion had shot a friend of his brother, and other residents in the town confirmed that shooting. And then a short time later, they encountered Sandra Tunis, who was a reporter for the Financial Times and also for the Monitor. And he was riding out of the city against the battalion. Shots were fired by Battalion 745 members on motorcycles. Eyewitnesses in the area say that the troops then dragged Sanders' body off the road, and that the coroner in Australia who investigated this incident concluded that that Sander was killed after being dragged away from the road. The convoy proceeded into Dili, and that's where they were briefed by the Dili regional commander, who told them that they should never speak of the events that had just occurred and that they should withhold any fire moving forward, because, of course, by that time, the Australian-led force had arrived in the territory, and the commander was worried that there would be some kind of altercation between Battalion 745 and Australian soldiers.
Now, Cameron Barr, you clearly retraced the trip of this convoy. Were you able to confirm that all of these shootings, these murders, were committed by this particular battalion? Did they have markings or any other identification on them that everyone knew that they were from Battalion 745?
Yes, that's exactly how we try to get confirmation. These soldiers were wearing their uniforms, and Indonesian soldiers wear they have unit insignia on all of their uniforms, and which is quite easy to see. And there wasn't any. I found incidents that killings and other and abductions where people were not certain of the unit, or where it seemed that another unit was responsible. Those, of course, didn't make it into my story. I concentrated only on the battalion because I thought it was indicative of, the battalion's behavior may be indicative of the behavior of other Indonesian units in East Timor at that time. But yes, people saw the soldiers in Los Palos. The soldiers were a part of the community. That was their headquarters. And it's a small town, basically, so there isn't a lot of ambiguity who was doing the killing. I talked to one man in Los Palos who witnessed his brother being abducted by 745 soldiers and also members of a local pro-Indonesia militia. And this man had written on a little piece of paper the names of the four soldiers he recognized. So there was a lot of, there were some clear recollections and even some, you know, contemporaneous notes that people had made that implicated the battalion.
We're talking to Cameron Barr, Christian Science Monitor reporter, who retraced the steps of Battalion 745, just finished a four-part series in the Monitor called A Brutal Exit, Battalion 745. His colleague, Sander Tunis, who wrote for the Financial Times and the Christian Science Monitor, was killed on that last day when Battalion 745 moved out of Dili, shot off of the motorcycle he was riding on, along with the Timorese. In the last piece, Cameron, you write about the politics of justice in East Timor, which goes to the issue of international war crimes and crimes against humanity. Where does the whole issue of justice fit in here, and the possibility of any kind of prosecutions?
Right now it rests with politics in Indonesia, which is a bitter irony because, of course, Indonesia occupied East Timor for 24 years. But that's where it stands. Both the United States, other governments, and the United Nations have said that they would like to see Indonesia handle this responsibly and bring to justice members of its military and other officials who are responsible for this violence. Right now, the Attorney General in Indonesia, Marzuki Darusman, is charged with doing just that, and it's difficult to say at this time what he will do. I think it is fair to say that that there's a lot more political will in Indonesia to pursue the military for other human rights violations, such as in the province of Aceh, because that will help Indonesia maintain its integrity and keep Aceh within the country. East Timor is a dead issue for Indonesians. It's over. They're out of there. There's no compelling political reason to bring these people to justice. The president of Indonesia, Abdurrahman Wahid, has used this issue as a tool of leverage to try to push the generals who have long been politically involved in Indonesia out of power. And in that sense, these terrible crimes in East Timor are having a positive effect because they're contributing to the democratization of Indonesia. But at the same time, I think there's a lot of skepticism in Jakarta that anyone will be brought to justice. In fact, President Wahid has already said that he will probably pardon General Wiranto, who was the chief of the armed forces during this period, if he's ever convicted of crimes. And of course, if you're going to pardon the top guy, how can you really imprison those below him who were simply obeying orders?
But of course, was he the top guy, General Wiranto? I mean, he was carrying out a policy that had gone on for a quarter of a century, a third of the population of Timor killed, 200,000 people, by a military, the Indonesian army, that was ultimately supported, financed, armed, trained by the United States.
In fact, the commander of Battalion 745 spent 6 months at the infantry college at Fort Benning in 1990. He was one of the you know, the Pentagon has justified its training of Indonesian officers as a, you know, as a step that contributes to the respect for human rights. But in this case, this commander's troops, we believe there's strong evidence to implicate them in the deaths of 21 people over a 10-day period.
Were you able in your investigation to determine how far up the chain of command the approval of these actions went?
Those are very murky waters. I was dealing with what happened on the ground, and the commander's name is Jacob Sarosa. I had dinner with him in Kupang in West Timor in January. Whether he ordered these things, he in fact denies them. He denies that they took place. He denies saying that his soldiers should destroy everything if the pro-independence forces in East Timor won the referendum. He's clearly in denial mode because his troops made terrible mistakes. And I think the most, in terms of justice, the worst mistake was to encounter these journalists, because as a result of encountering John Swain apparently killing Sander Tunis, an awful lot of attention is being focused on this battalion, and I think they realize that. And, at the same time, the responsibility from this has to go up the chain of command. The Indonesia's own Human Rights Commission investigating East Timor has named six generals as being responsible. So I think there's very just ample reason to look up the chain of command.
And just in summary, in September, this after the historic vote took place on August 30th, you're saying that people are estimating 500 murders took place in East Timor. This is the Indonesian troops were leaving East Timor. And of course, the forensic work that has to be done on the ground in East Timor is just a part of the overall tremendous amount of work that has to be done since the Indonesian military really razed that country, destroyed, burned the buildings, the towns, the capital, before they left.
Yes, I think it has to be said that Interfed, the troops that went into East Timor to restore order, did a terrific job, but they were not prepared to do this forensic work and to do this human rights work. And that's one of the problems that we're running into now, is that a lot of evidence has gone away.
Well, Cameron Barr, I want to thank you for being with us. His four-part series appears throughout the week this week in the Christian Science Monitor, which you can find on the web by just putting in Christian Science Monitor as a keyword. It's called A Brutal Exit, Battalion 745. Thank you for doing that work. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! And as we end today's program, this St. Patrick's Day, we're going out into the streets of New York to Fifth Avenue, where there are two parades taking place. One is the St. Patrick's Day Parade, and one is the Irish Lesbian Gay Organization that has gathered, and we expect protests. Laura Flanders is on the street. Laura, are you there?
Yes, I'm here at the right outside the Plaza Hotel at 59th and 5th with the Irish Lesbian and Gay Organization. The organization started 10 years ago as a social and cultural organization to support Irish gay and lesbian people who may have been new immigrants to the New York area. They didn't know they were going to become a political activist group until a year later when they applied to participate in the annual St. Patrick's Day parade organized by the Ancient Order of Hibernians. When the Ancient Order refused their permit to take part, suddenly they were thrust into the position of being an activist organization fighting for their rights. Now it's been 10 years, and their case has been through almost every level of state court fighting for the right to participate. 2 years ago, Mayor Giuliani declared that the denial of a permit to the Irish Lesbian and Gay Organization constituted a victory for his quality of life clampdown on crime campaign in New York. I'm here with the activists from ILGO, who are right now beginning to try to make their way into the street while the police is moving towards closing off their route. Marie Honan is one of the organizers of ILGO. This is Marie Honan.
Hi, we're on a march. We're on a demonstration now on 59th Street and 5th Avenue. We're going to close on 5th Avenue soon. And there are about 70 people over from Ireland to demonstrate with us. It's a major event, and that's it.
That was Marie Honan, and as she said, there is a whole delegation over here from Northern Ireland and from Southern Ireland. In Ireland, it's not forbidden to take part in a St. Patrick's Day parade. Catherine O'Donnell is one of the delegates from Dublin.
We have the right to be here.
Hello?
Hi there, this is Catherine O'Donnell. I'm from Cork, and I flew over especially to protest with the ILGO demonstrators here today.
Well, we thank you.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we thank you all very much for being with us, and we have to wrap up the program on this St. Patrick's Day as Irish, lesbian, and gay members of ILGO are about to be arrested right outside, right near St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York. Well, if you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230 or write to us at democracy@pacifica.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by David Love, Maria Carrion, and Sputnik Colombi. Errol Maitland is our technical director from the studios of WBAI in New York. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!